secrets of Black women.
Right. I don't know. Like, I feel like we're exposing secrets now at this point, Nia.
Hello, I'm Nia Patterson, and welcome to episode 2 of Body Trauma. Today, we are going to be talking with Ayana Habtemarian. She is a registered dietitian specializing in intuitive eating and, as always, fighting back against diet culture. But before we get started, I want to put a warning that this conversation is not censored and can include potentially triggering material. We also don't censor for cursing, but we will bleep out any numbers regarding weight or exercise activity. If you're new here, we listen to people tell the story of their bodies. This might include discrimination based on race, gender, size, sexuality, and more, and the different trauma that they have experienced in their body, including mental and physical health, eating disorders, body image, sexual assault, gender transition, and so much more. I'm really excited to go speak with Ayana, so here we are. So I just want to say hello to Ayana Habtemarian. She is here today, and it is so great to have you here. I really appreciate you coming on here and talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I am Ayana. I am a Black, able-bodied, cisgender, heterosexual woman. I'm a registered dietitian. I have been for about 13 years, since 2007, from Philadelphia, living in Arlington, Virginia. Gosh, what I was trying to do was not lead with my profession, but I feel like there's not a whole lot to say about it. So I'm a certified intuitive eating counselor. I'm also a macro social worker, meaning that I try to help individuals more at the institutional, societal level with social issues rather than at that individual clinical level.
Okay. All right. So I guess we will just get started. What has life been like in your body?
Yeah, so that's a really heavy question. And I could probably talk for days about it. But I guess what I can say is life in my body, it's been like a roller coaster. It's had its ups, it's had its downs. It's had, you know, some scary times, but I've experienced much trauma, much insecurity, a lot of body oppression, I would say. Right now we're in the middle of, you know, the COVID-19 crisis, and mm-hmm. what I'm seeing happen with Black communities as a result of it is also bringing out a lot of what I felt growing up, and a lot of what I've experienced. Like early on, I always felt that I think I should just give a heads up that I'm feeling kind of emotional right now, pretty emotional about just the state of Black bodies and in the state of the oppression of Black bodies that we're experiencing with COVID-19, with the crisis and how it's affecting Black communities, as well as what recently happened with Ahmaud Arbery. And it's bringing out a lot of feelings of anger, a lot of feelings of rage, lots of emotions. And I've always been a very emotional person and a very sensing person. And it's like all these emotions and all my experiences are like really mixed up, and I'm not, you know, and I'm having trouble feeling them. I'm having trouble like separating them, you know what I mean? So when you ask me about my experience in my body and life with my body, there's so many things that I can bring up when it comes to trauma. I remember my mom telling me, she might bring it up now, saying something like, yeah, you had a chip on your shoulder growing up. And it was because, this is what I think, it was because, like, looking back on it, when I was little, I experienced anti-Blackness based on my skin color and based on my hair type, my hair texture, really early on. And it was painful. It hurt me. But even as a child, it also made me angry. You know what I mean? And
okay,
there's this one experience in third grade where a little white girl in my class asked me about my skin and, you know, gave me a nasty face. And I just wanted to be friends with her, but she didn't like how my skin looked. And I think that was one of the things that kind of set the stage for that anger and for that confusion around why someone didn't like me based on how I looked, or why someone would be angry with me based on how I look. And then there were so many other messages being, you know, just portrayed in the media that were anti-Black and just anti-me, anti who I was. And I just think that all kind of created this idea in my mind that I wasn't good enough. And even though I grew up in a household where my mom was really intentional about saying, no, you are good enough. Your hair is good and your skin is good and you're smart and the way you speak is good. All those things are good about you. It still didn't, I believed her and she set a really great example. But when you go out into the world and you're rejected, you have these messages, these mass messages of rejection, just based on the dolls in the stores and the images that you see on TV and the images that you see on magazines, that really, I think, had a bigger effect on me than anything could. And so,
right, like you can't avoid it.
And so I would say that was the start of my own self-hate. I feel like self-hate is strong, but I think it is what it is, with my own self-hate. I remember being about 7 years old and running around the house with a t-shirt on my head. And I was saying, and it was like long. I was saying, like, look, mom, this is my hair. And I was running around the house with it all day. And I remember her, like maybe a couple hours later, saying, take that off your head. That's enough. That's enough. That's not your hair. And it doesn't need to be your hair. Like, kind of put me in my place, telling me to take it off my head. And I don't know. I just have these really vivid memories of not liking myself. I thought my mom was beautiful. I thought the women in my family were great, you know, but I still didn't like who I was. And that started really early when I realized that my skin was wrong and that my nose was wrong. Like I have my grandmother's nose, like a broad nose. And I remember telling her, I wish my nose was more narrow. And she said, your nose is just like mine. You don't like your nose and it's just like mine. And as an adult, as a woman in my 30s now, it's like, oh my God, I love this nose. And I miss my grandmother. And I wish I didn't tell her that. And I got braces. Ooh, I'm getting emotional. Sorry. I remember I had braces and I lost my retainer. And so my gap came back. My front teeth, it's small now. And I remember, yeah.
I got one too.
And I hated the gap, but it's my grandmother's gap too. Mm-hmm. And all her family has it. And I'm like, why do I have this big gap? And I love this gap. I adore this gap. And I didn't lose my retainer. A cousin threw it away. And I'm so glad she threw it away. She was mad at me. And years later told me that she threw my retainer away. And my mom was like, that's the second retainer I got you. You're not getting another one. So
that is money.
She's like, you're not getting another retainer. So my gap came back. And I'm just so grateful because I have this nose that reminds me of my grandmother and this gap that reminds me of my grandmother. These things, these features that I hated so much. These very Black features that I love and that I appreciate now so much. And it's just something, you know, how you go through that process, that it's a process even beginning as a child and, you know, learning through images in the media and learning through society and everything around you that you're not good enough. And then seeing it for the lie that it is, because it's such a lie. And I don't know why. I don't know why we're meant to feel that way, you know?
Yeah, and you don't get the realization that it's alive until much later on.
And you look back and you wish, you know, it's like, if I knew then what I know now, so many things would be different. You know, just so many things would be different. And I think that really does tie into my body size and why I wanted to change my body size so much, like my body dysmorphia. And even now, when I look back at pictures of me, I legit had to have some sort of like diagnosable, like diagnosis, because when I look back and the things that I did, and again, knowing what I know about eating disorders and through my studies now as an intuitive eating counselor, and now that I am getting eating disorder clients, I probably should have been diagnosed with an eating disorder. But at my smallest, I was praised. The only person that didn't praise me at my smallest was my mom. She was just like, no, this is a little concerning. You've never had legs that skinny.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I always had like legs and, you know, and once those went down, she was just like, I don't know about this. You need to gain some weight. And then I didn't go down that small again, but it was all praise. When I started restricting as much as I was restricting, and it just goes hand in hand with wanting to fit into these unrealistic ideals of beauty, upholding these Eurocentric standards of beauty that, you know, I would never meet. And so, yeah, that's a really small piece. When I was like reading a lot of the questions and even listening to the first episode, I was thinking about like harassment and catcalling and some of the trauma that's caused. And I was like, I don't know. I think Nia and I could talk about body trauma and life in my body and my body being oppressed for hours and hours, you know. And there are even some things that came up that I'm like, I'm not even going to bring that up. You know what I mean? So
in the first episode, we only touched on like maybe 10 out of the list of like 30 maybe. Yeah. Like, and we only touched on them. Like, so many people are just experiencing so many different things in their bodies.
Oh my God, so many different things. You guys talked about bullying, you talked about sexual harassment. Yeah, you talked about so much stuff, and even the bullying thing. I had a bully what grade was this? I think it was it the same grade? Oh my God, I think it was the same grade, in the third grade. And I think, I'm thinking about all these traumatic things, and it was extremely traumatic for me, having that bully. She hit me, she punched me, and I was afraid to hit her back, and I never did. Yeah, it was hard. Gosh, third grade was kind of hard, I guess.
Elementary school is rough.
Yeah.
Like, it is rough as a kid.
It really is. And you kind of compartmentalize and put those memories away. And then when they come out, it's like, I don't know. I guess you could either be proud that you made it through and say that this is what, you know, this is what helped me become the person that I am. But those memories are painful. I know, especially when I was thinking about, like racism growing up. I grew up in South Philadelphia, and it can be a very diverse community, South Philly, but it's also like you have Italians, and then you might have like a street with Irish people, and then you'll have Black people, and then you'll have your Asian community, and then they're, you know, like, and then like,
so they're sectioned off into their own little areas.
Yeah, everybody's like sectioned off, and some are mixed, you know. You also have some mix. It's really changing, and it's also gentrifying now. But I remember another thing I was thinking about in school. I don't know, this is weird, but I went to school with a lot of Italians, Puerto Ricans, Asian people, and Irish people. And there's a street right around the corner from my house that's like mostly Irish, and like a whole area of them actually in South Philly. And in school, you're friends. Like, we joke around, you're friends. And the first time I realized that outside of school, they ignore you, or it's like you don't even exist. I think I was like in fourth or fifth grade. And so, Yeah, I was like, hey, like waving, and the person just looked right past me. And that's the thing, they do. Like, they'll be your friend in school, but when they're around their families and out in the neighborhood, they're not your friend. And that, I mean, that was kind of painful too. All I wanted to do was be friends, you know, and
right.
That just was impossible. And I remember it happened in high school too. I remember it was a white guy, an Irish guy that I used to always joke around with. And, you know, we were like buddies. We were really cool. And I remember seeing him in the neighborhood. I was like, hey, I mean, joking. And he was just like, walked right past me. I was like, oh shit, I forgot that this is what they do. You know what I mean? And
wow.
In school, when I saw him, wow. I was like, what was up with that? Like, that wasn't cool. You know what I mean? And this is high school. We were like 10th, 11th grade. He was like, I mean, I can't. I mean, what do you want me to say outside of school? I'm just like, yeah, that wasn't cool. And so
that's interesting.
Yeah,
I've never actually experienced that.
Oh yeah, it's big in South Philly. I don't know if it is now, but because that was years and years ago, but I'm sure it is. I mean, I had a friend who in high school got pregnant by a black person. She was Italian and was disowned by her family. And so it's really, really common.
So when you were bullied as a kid, were you mostly bullied by white children or other children of color?
So I had one bully. It was a black bully. She was my grade. I remember her name. I remember her first name, her last name. She had a big sister who was probably like 7th or 8th grade. And just knowing that was scary, knowing in 3rd grade that the bully had a sister, and they were both mean. When I look back at it, I just remember the sister being big, the girl just being really mean to me. And I don't know why. Like, I told the teacher, I told my sister, I remember crying at home. And yeah, so that was, I just had one bully. Like, the racial stuff, they weren't really bullies. It was just, they just made it very known and made it very clear that I was different and that my skin was different, and that I wasn't good enough, and they didn't like me. And I think I was saying, like, I've always been really good at sensing. And so even if somebody didn't say it, I feel like as black people, we learn really early on, we get this experience, this cultural, or this just our lived experience, when people don't like us, we sense it and we get those vibes. We know that. And a lot of people, other people don't see that. They don't recognize that. So you learn that really early on. And I think this chip on my shoulder against white people that I had growing up, even though it's weird because I wanted to be friends with everybody, but I also developed like this chip, and I began to think that they were all just really mean people. Also happened at a school that I was going to. I think I was in 1st grade when this happened. A teacher was really mean to me, and I hyperpigment really easily, so I get marks on my skin really easily, and she pinched me. And she pinched me and left a mark. And I went home and told my mom. My mom called my dad. And my mom is like the reasonable parent, and my dad is the fuck shit up parent. And so,
okay.
So she's like, this teacher, you know, did this to Ayana. And I don't know. I was a good kid. I'm pretty sure I was a good kid. And I don't know why this teacher was mean or she didn't like me, but it was mostly a white school at the time. And my dad went up to the school and had a conversation with her, and she never picked on me again, but they obviously took me out of the school after that. And so I just had so many experiences that just shaped, you know, my worldview. And
I find that interesting because I feel like for me, it's kind of the opposite. Like, I grew up not wanting to be black, I think, obviously, but my like chip on my shoulder was like towards other black people. Mm-hmm. And so like I got bullied for being like quote unquote too white, mm-hmm. and speaking too white and hanging out with the white kids. And so I just dubbed black people as ghetto, mm-hmm. and not who I wanted to associate with. And I think honestly, it's taken me until adulthood, almost out of college, to interact with other black people in in like an okay, like self-motivated way. So I definitely understand the chip on your shoulder, but I just think it's interesting that yours was directed towards the oppressor and mine was just directed towards the oppressee, which is essentially myself as well.
You know, that is interesting, but I've heard that a lot, you know, and I know that that's true. Like, I know that Black people will say that, like, oh, you sound white. I remember, so this is, wait, I don't want to like jump. I feel like I'm about to start jumping all over the place, but
that's fine.
I remember my mom, for example, even though she grew up like in the projects and in Philadelphia, she always spoke really proper and would always correct me, my sister and mine's English. And like, and she has a degree in English, and I would be embarrassed for my mom to come to the school, because we went to schools where, especially like, we just went to schools like regular city schools, like regular Philadelphia city schools. And I don't know if my sister would, I would be embarrassed, because I would be like, mom, you speak too proper. You can't speak like that. Like, I wanted her to be, like I said, the parent who was like finger pointing and,
yes, and
that was not my mom. My mom was soft-spoken, well-spoken in a traditional English context, in a traditional English kind of way. I was just embarrassed. I wanted her to be that quote unquote ghetto parent, but that wasn't who she was.
Right.
And and I get that, because I didn't want anybody to say, you know, well, your mom sounds white, because that's what the kids would say.
Yes.
And I think our experiences, yours, mine, all of our experiences are so valid, and it kind of bothers me when we're just lumped together, you know? We're not a monolith.
As Black people.
Yeah, as Black people. It's like, you know, you had an opposite experience when it came to like bullying from me, and that doesn't make my experience any more Black or any more valid than yours.
No.
You know what I mean? I feel like people definitely believe that, though, you know?
Yes.
And another thing that I was thinking about, did I tell you, did I mention like catcalling and the sexual harassment?
I think you said sexual harassment, but I don't think you talked about it.
Okay, so I'm not going to get that deep into it, but one thing that I remember when you were talking about with your BFF on the first episode was like the catcalling. And so when we were younger, going to our grandparents' neighborhoods, they lived in like Southwest Philadelphia, which was a little bit more rough, like a rougher area than from where we came from in South Philadelphia.
Okay.
And so there were a lot of corner stores and people who hung out, like men and young men who hung out in front of the corner stores. And I remember being like 11 years old. I think it started when I was like 11, 12, when my body started to develop, and being afraid to walk to the stores and walk around the corner because they would be like, yo, short A, what's up? Like, you know how.
That's the worst.
And it's a shame that I know like the exact language and tone of voice, but it's like,
oh, it is horrible.
It's horrible. Like, Shode, come here. And it's like, and I remember, I have my sister and my mom who are really curvy. And I was always told that I'm like built, this is horrible, that I'm built like my dad's side of the family, like whose butts are a little bit flatter. And I was always insecure about that. And this is happening. It's funny to me now, but it's horrible. It's really bad too. But I remember ignoring people. This started at like 11 years old, like ignoring these men and young men and being called like pancake or flat booty, like all kinds of stuff, you know, like being called names. I remember I went home and told my aunt, because we were at my grandmom's, and she walked me back around the corner. Walked me and my sister around the corner and said, she's 12 and she's 14. Don't you say another thing to them. And I don't think they did for a little while, but until this very day, I feel so much anxiety when I walk in front of a group of men, because I'm just so used to them.
Yes.
Undressing me with their eyes and just saying nasty things. And, you know, it's, That's just
and it switches. It switches from like I want you, let me go after you, to now you're ignoring me, you're a bitch.
Yes, exactly. And it's scary.
And now I'm gonna hurl the insults once you become a bitch.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know what else though? I remember at one point, maybe when I was like 16, 17, like feeling some type of way if people didn't look at me or call me or try to say something to me. I would think, oh my God, I must look bad or I must not look good enough. Isn't that, and I hate to admit that, but I remember there was a period, probably a long period, probably from like 17, 18 to like 25 or something,
yeah,
that I would be like, all right, I would feel validated if someone called me or tried to.
I can definitely relate to that. Yeah. I can definitely relate to that. And I remember, like, for me, like, I would get, like, specifically upset or feel left out if we were at, like, a college dance or, like, a high school dance. Mm-hmm. And, like, the weird, creepy, horn dog, like, college boys were, like, trying to dance on my friends, but not me.
Oh, my God. Yes. I remember college days like that. Like, I didn't want to be felt up on or anything like that. But if nobody wanted to dance with me, I would also feel like, oh man, I must not be good enough. You know, I didn't say and it in those exact
definitely
words,
contributed but to like body image.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think like body image was my biggest thing, but body image for me included so much. Body image included like prettiness and skin and marks and just like I had so many issues with body. And I'm so thankful that I eventually, I think pretty early on, because I was probably like 16, 17, when I finally started loving my skin and being okay with my stretch marks and being okay with all the hyperpigmentation and like the little hairs under, you know, my chin. And I'm grateful for that. But I still had a lot of issues around my body size and my weight. You know, I had a whole lot of issues.
I remember like, I mean, I don't think that white people go through this, but I remember my grandmother, because I'm adopted by my grandmother. She's my mother. She would always get on me about having like dark elbows and like dark knees and like, you need to lotion them so that the darkness goes away, which still, I don't understand how that works. But like, it was another insecurity that like, oh my God, my elbows are dark, or like I have that like pigmentation. Like,
yes.
Yes.
Oh my God. Like the whole ashy elbow and ashy knee thing and just ash in general.
Ash in general.
Like just in Black families, it's hilarious and it's so real. I didn't even think about that because that is part of the reason. Like, can I say that I feel like if my elbows are ashy, I don't know where that belief came from, but they will be darker, you know, like if you lotion them, yes, or moisturize them, your skin is smoother and therefore like they won't be as hyperpigmented. I don't know. It's, I don't know what that is.
I don't know either. I know that some Black people have like darker patches, like on their knees or their elbows or their underarms. Some people don't. Mm-hmm. And it's usually the people who are like models or like in socially acceptable bodies who don't have that pigmentation, the hyperpigmentation. Their armpits are like the same color as the rest of their body. And I know that like, I've never even talked about that. I don't even think anyone even knows that like, I am like self-conscious about my underarms because they're darker than the rest of my body.
Yeah.
Like little things like that.
Yeah, mine are too. And I hated it for a long time. I hated it. I don't know if it's that I'm used to it now, but you know what it is? It's not that I'm used to it. I've just learned to manage it. So now I know why or how to prevent them from becoming any darker because I've spent so many years of my life on it. But yeah, they're darker and even when I was younger and noticed that they were darker, I wouldn't lift my underarms up. I would just leave them down. Now I don't care. Mm-hmm. Like, get some hair underneath them right now and I'll be like, hey, what's up? You know what I mean? And it's dark and a little bit hairy. So I don't know why I'm saying this on the podcast, but
you're good. You're good. It's real. It's real.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah, we have like darker underarms, some of us. And I mean, it is what it is. We need to normalize these things. We need to normalize dark elbows and dark underarms and yeah, all this stuff.
I just get so frustrated sometimes because it's always like that like very diet cultured phrase of like, if you could change like one thing about your body, what would you change? And like, I was always over there with like my clipboard, like running down the list, like which one's most important? Like, do I want like my stomach smaller? Do I want my thighs smaller? Do I want my underarms lighter? Do I want like perfectly moisturized skin? Like what, like, diet culture just gives you the longest list ever of like every little thing that could be wrong with your body.
Yes. And it's a lie. It's bullshit. I'm just tired of it.
Like it shouldn't matter. Like,
yeah,
I've given up on lotioning my legs. So I am in a constant state of ash unless I'm going to visit my family, in which case then I will make it better.
You know what? I don't even know. I'm going to admit this. Like, I still will put lotion on, but like right now, for example, the only lotion in the house that we have, like normally there's like shea butter, cocoa butter, you know, all the butters that Black people use, like, you know, all the oils. And right now, like I had an episode where my skin got really dry. And so I bought Eucerin, like that thick Eucerin.
Oh, yes.
And so it was putting it on my dry arms. But that stuff is too thick to be lotioning. You know how like our parents and grandparents like taught us how we know how to lotion down our whole bodies? It's too thick to be lotioning down my whole body. So I've been pretty ashy too.
Secrets of Black women.
Right. I don't know. Like, I feel like we're exposing secrets now at this point, Nia.
I mean, I will just say it. I can't cornrow.
Oh, I can't either.
I can't. I'm in the secret society. We're in the secret society of Black women who can't cornrow.
Yeah. But you know what? So my sister and my best friend cornrow really well. Like, and anytime I want my sister locks cornrowed or braided, like I have to go to Philly for it. So I'm not too ashamed about it. I guess I'm not ashamed at all. But there was a time when, you know, of course I can braid, but I cannot cornrow. And I feel like you have, as a Black person, like you have to know how to cornrow, a Black woman. Cause what if, what if your cousin or somebody needs cornrows or like, I don't know.
Right. Like, you should be able to sit down on the couch in front of the TV at like a moment's notice and like whip out some like exotic styles.
I love it. I love it. And I kind of still want to learn, but then mostly I don't, but I just feel like,
I have watched YouTube videos. It is too hard for me.
I love that you can't cornrow. Yay, me either. One thing I would want to say is that just rejection and body oppression being forms of intergenerational trauma, individual trauma, and collective trauma that I think that we as Black people all experience to some degree. You know what I mean? And I just think it's really interesting how that trauma manifests and how it plays out. You know, I know for me, one of the questions that you asked is how I deal with it. And when I was thinking about answering that question, what I realized is that I don't deal with it well at all. I don't deal with this trauma at all. What I do is I become really numb to it. I compartmentalize and I put it away.
I do too.
Yeah. And at random points, it might just come out. You know what I mean? Like when I was talking to you earlier about my grandmother and started crying, I feel like that's something that I could have been thinking about her, thinking about the memory, but I may have to get some closure around that for myself, you know?
Right.
And I don't like talking to therapists about it. I don't do very well in therapy. And maybe I have never found a good therapist, but.
What does do well in therapy look like? I feel like that's an oxymoron.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't stay in therapy for a long time.
Okay.
And once it starts getting hard, I don't like to go back. I feel like I feel like it's just, it's too much. You know, sometimes it's too much. I remember this therapist, I only saw her once, but at the very first appointment, I don't know how she identified something about like my relationship, and I have a great relationship with my father. But I think there's some sort of trauma there around like the divorce between him and my mother and just always wanting him and not understanding why he wasn't there. And for a long time, like I used to like kind of make fun of people who were like really bent out of shape or not, I wouldn't make fun of them, but I would be like, I mean, people divorce all the time. My parents divorced. Like as I got older, like what's the big deal about it? But then realizing that I had a lot of shit around that, you know what I mean? When I was little, and I don't know how this therapist identified it, but I didn't like that she brought up my father on the first, in the first appointment, on the first session. And I didn't want to go back. I'm like, I'm not talking about my dad. This isn't about my dad. You know what I mean? Like kind of stuff like that. And I've had a lot of therapists and not a lot, but I've tried enough.
It seems like you are content to lock down and anyone who pushes against your wall, you're like, no, 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 no. And I say that as someone who had like, and still has a very, very, very thick wall.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I do. And I think another thing, I know I don't have it all figured out, but when it comes to things really, really close to me and people I love and experiences that might have been hard that for me are hard to admit are difficult, I don't want people to get too close to that. I become very protective around that space. And I don't know. So when I guess the way doing well in therapy looks is I think letting someone in and letting someone in that can recognize those things like that one therapist did and help me with it. Cause she was, I think she was onto something, you know,
yes.
And I didn't allow her to continue in that work with me. I guess to answer the question and how does that look? I guess I wouldn't know. Because I never stay long enough.
I think it's hard too, because so much of like what we deal with is like shadowed by like racism and fat phobia. And like, I mean, honestly, a majority of therapists are thin white women. And so it's hard to go into a session and unpack those things with someone who either is like never experienced it or just doesn't understand it. And that's something that I've run into with just like never being able to like unpack racism and like how I suffer from it and how my body holds on to it, mm-hmm. because I don't feel comfortable unpacking it with someone who's white. Mm-hmm. I don't.
Yeah. I feel like I feel that way too. And I remember I had a white therapist and I think I was with her for the longest because she let me talk a lot. And the way that she answered questions or asked questions, I like the way that she asked questions. I forget what style she used, but I also felt like she was observing me more than like just watching my behavior and learning about me. Like, I don't think she had a whole lot of black clients, and that's just an assumption on my part, but it's just something that I sensed and I didn't like that. And I felt that I gave her too much information. And so again, that's me being defensive too, because I also said in the same breath that I stayed with her the longest because I like, you know, how she framed questions, you know, so yeah, it's hard to talk about those things with people who don't have the experience and can't really understand it, or might look at me and say, well, why would you have issues around your body? You
right look
this way, or you know.
And I get a little jaded, I have to admit, because like my therapist right now is thin and white, and part of me is just like, I mean, I want to be in your body because you experience less oppression than I do. And that just sounds amazing to me. And I know that I can't just jump into someone else's body. That's unrealistic. So sitting with someone who is a constant reminder of like things that I wish I had is painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that just, it just speaks to what it's like being in a body, being in a body that's Black, or a body that's Black and trans, a body that's Black and fat, and just understanding why, or it provides some understanding to why we try to change so much, you know, and why we do the things that we do to our, with our eating and exercising, bleaching. I know a lot of people still do that.
Yes.
And just changing. And I don't think people who don't have that lived experience, obviously they can never understand it.
I mean, I think it makes so much sense that like no one wants any more trauma in their life, in their body. So of course people are going to engage in anything that will lessen that trauma, yeah, like bleaching their skin or weight loss, that sort of thing. Just in any attempt to fit into the social norm. I understand completely why people do it, which is why I always say, like, I'm not upset if you choose to go on a diet. I just don't think that the world should make you feel like you have to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree completely. Of course, it's damaging. I think it does more damage in the long run, but if that's what people need to do to cope, or if that's what they feel that they need to do, or try it, it's not in alignment with my personal values, but that's no reason for me to tell someone else that they're wrong for doing it, because I've been there, you know. So the other thing, it's still around what you've asked me about dealing with the trauma that I've encountered. And I feel like we may have talked about this, but one thing that I wrote was with body oppression. And in terms of believing that people with hair like mine and skin like mine couldn't be beautiful, I began to see that that was a lie. And I began to see that that was a lie around like the neo-soul late 90s, early 2000s movement, with like artists like Jill Scott, Kindred the Family, and they were wearing their hair natural. And even though mm-hmm. it was something that, you know, I had always been aware of and had always been taught, it wasn't really until that time that I saw it and looked at myself and realized that, oh, well, this can be beautiful too. And that was another way I dealt with, I think, some of the trauma around my own self-image. But then I also think that it's kind of sad that that had to come from outside myself. You know, like I really wish that it came from within. I wish that I didn't have to see other people being comfortable and beautiful, or accepted, not just beautiful, but just being accepted and respected in their bodies meant that, oh, I can be accepted and respected in mine too. And I can wear my hair natural like them, and I can, you know, accept my skin because they accept theirs. And I really wish that I had that within me for me to see that for myself, but I didn't, you know, but it still helped me deal, you know, seeing those images of other people being proud really did help me. I needed to see that.
I feel that same way with like larger fat bodies. Just like it took me being in an Instagram space where there are fat bodies and there are women and men loving their fat bodies and accepting them and being comfortable in them to accept my own body. Mm-hmm. And even then, it was still and still is an uphill battle. Mm-hmm. But I just almost don't know how you could manifest that yourself, because even like everything that we know has been taught to us by someone else, mm-hmm. like even as a baby. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And if we're never taught that it's okay to love ourselves, or if that voice just isn't loud enough, because like you said, your mother was telling you that you were good as you are. And my grandmother told me that too, but if it's not loud enough to beat out the rest of the world, you just don't have a chance.
Yeah. And you're so right though, about the way culture is learned and socialization and how the world is what teaches us, and we're humans and we absorb those things. So I guess you're right. I mean, it's not, you have people who it can come from within, but I don't think that's the norm. I think that's the exception, you know?
I think so too.
And it's just, we learn from what's around us, and I'm glad there are people like you and, you know, other activists who are changing, like, you know, the social media landscape, and hopefully it'll go beyond social media, so that people can see images of themselves and representations of themselves and say, oh, this is normal. It's, and just making it normal, not anything that's supposed to be like, oh, this is so grand, and look at this person doing, this larger body person doing this. No, no, just needs to be
like the Lizzo effect.
Yeah, exactly, like the Lizzo effect. Ugh, bothers me, but you know.
Like, I love Lizzo, but like, just the sheer, like, everyone being like, look at this amazing woman, like, loving her body, like, and she's just like, I'm just trying to do music.
Right.
Like, why do I have to be the poster child for this just because I happen to be fat?
Yep. And that's just how it is. And then it's just her. Why aren't there more people? You know, why? And that's the reason that it is that way, that she is.
There's room for like one.
Right, exactly. There was room for one.
And I feel like that is also the case with like women of color. Mm-hmm. Like, there is room for one.
Yep.
Like, it can't be Nicki Minaj and Cardi B. It has to be Nicki Minaj or Cardi B. And I was listening to, because I am absolutely obsessed with Tinashe, just a little known fact about myself. But she said in one interview that so many of her fans would come up to her and say, like, I mean, I like your music, but I can't like you the most because I really like Normani. Like, as if they couldn't like people at once that were Black.
Yeah. That's a problem. I mean, how do we get past that?
Like, the sheer amount of white men,
girl,
that there are that are loved and are like high up in their field, whatever field that is, whether it's medicine or acting or I don't even know what else, but like, just there are so many white men who all look the same. There's room for like 10 of them. But there's only room for like one Black woman doctor.
Yeah, at a time. And then once one's on top, like the other ones we forget about. So.
Right.
Body oppression itself, I think murder and life being taken away is the worst form of body oppression and trauma for those of us who have to endure that, and for those of us who have to witness it on a daily basis and become so numb to it. Because I hate the fact that we're numb to it. I hate the fact that Black people are unarmed, being murdered unarmed, but you can have so many people protesting in Michigan with guns out, belligerent in people's, in law enforcement's faces, and not being arrested, not being violently beaten to the ground. But we can just go out for a run. We can be driving to work. Our children can be playing with BB guns and they're murdered. It's just, I think that's probably the worst form of trauma that we're all experiencing together. And the way that it's showing up for me, I don't know. I feel fatigued. I feel drained. Sometimes I feel like I'm supposed to be talking about it on social media because I'm Black and I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to be that vulnerable in front of people who I think want to see me vulnerable or just want to hear, you know, just want to see me perform anger. You know, even if anger is not what I want to perform, I don't know. These are just my thoughts around it.
I feel you.
And
I feel you.
It's just, I don't know. For me, that's what's heaviest on my heart right now. And I know I mentioned it earlier about COVID-19 and the rate at which Black people are dying.
Yes.
And I'm afraid. I mean, you know, history can speak for itself when it comes to healthcare and Black people, and just allowing us to die. And I don't, and I'm not saying that's happening. I'm not trying to perpetuate any misinformation or spread any misinformation or anything, but.
But it's factual mm-hmm. that Black people are dying at a higher rate than other races from COVID right now.
Yeah, and they're saying that it's because...
Just in terms of percentages.
Yeah, in terms of percentages. And I feel like it's being said that it's because we have higher incidences of chronic diseases and higher BMIs. And I'm just not buying it. I don't buy it. And I'm just tired of us being oppressed. And I think that... You know, true body liberation means that all bodies, Black bodies, fat bodies, all bodies have equal access and ability, and are valued in the same way. And we're not dying and right. we're not being hunted down and shot in the streets. And we don't have that. And it's hard to have to witness that. It's hard to have to see that. You know, our fathers and our sons and our brothers and our uncles and nephews, you know, I have a 7-year-old nephew, can be shot in the street, like an animal being hunted, and the perpetrator not be arrested for it. The murderers not being arrested. They're allowed to go home and sit down while we protest and write letters and send emails. So,
And it feels like a show of like, sometimes they are arrested, sometimes they're kept in jail and they're brought before courts and then they're just let off. Like, it feels like a show put on to just like try and appease us, mm-hmm. even though in the end they're not facing justice.
Right. Yes. Yep. You're absolutely right. That's exactly what it is. And it is, it's a show. It's a performance. Like, okay, well, let's put this show on so we can quiet them down. But yeah, something's got to give. And I think, I don't know, I feel like I just keep going back to it because that's where I feel that in my body a lot. I feel that in my body more than I feel anything. And I know before we started recording, I mentioned that I remember feeling this way. And during the time, I felt really, really strong about Philando Castile. And when he was shot, and I remember just staying in the bed all day crying. I wore all black like for the rest of the week, not as mourning, like, cause you know, black is a mourning color. I don't know why, but just more, to make a statement and show my anger and show my rage. But I was quiet and solemn and just really upset. And I think since then, even though there have been so many more murders, I have been so numb, extremely numb to it.
Yes.
And I don't know what it's doing to my body. I have no idea, but I know that it's probably not good, whatever it's doing. And I don't know how, sometimes I wonder how our foremothers and forefathers put up with so much and how their children were taken away from them and how they were separated from their families. And they saw their people lynched on a daily basis and beaten and raped. And I just don't know how we as a people have endured this for so many years. And
I mean, I think two things mm-hmm. about that. I think we know about like PTSD mm-hmm. that was felt from slaves that has been passed down in the body mm-hmm. to descendants like us. But I also think that each of these videos of like Black men being shot, Black women being shot, and not even the ones where they get shot, but they're just like harassed.
Yeah.
I think all of that is just like a little hit to your body. Mm-hmm. Not only is it a hit to the body of the person who is experiencing it firsthand, but I think as like a bystander, we take it on and we are numb, because I think if we weren't numb, we wouldn't be able to handle all that we handle. I just think it is a testament to how strong and resilient Black bodies are. Mm-hmm. And I think that we just take it on each time, and eventually we break down because it's just too much, but I feel like it's just an additional piece of trauma every video.
Yes.
Every moment. And I said, like, in the first episode, I said, I can't watch another Black man being shot. And then now we have this this other video, and I thought that was just very poignant.
Yeah, I agree. And I remember you saying that in the first video. And when Ahmaud, and yeah, you're just so, you just said so much that I agree with, especially like the a little bit of trauma, you know, on a daily basis when we see those things and seeing these videos. And but there was a video of a white woman who was arguing or harassing, and I think she was drunk and walking her dog, a group of Black men, young Black men, asking them, why are you in this neighborhood? Do you live here? And she was just being really disrespectful, really nasty, as usual, and kicked one of them. And can you imagine if he would have hit her back, or if he would have defended himself?
Yes.
And it was, I had to turn it off, but I can't watch these videos and I can't talk about them anymore either. We're talking about it now, but I just can't give my thoughts on social media because I don't even know what to say. I just feel so much rage and so much pain as a result of it. It's just, I don't know what else to do, what we can do. I don't know.
It feels very displaced too, because you do have all this rage and there's like nothing constructive to do with it. There's nowhere for it to go because you never get that justice to appease that.
Yeah. Yep. We don't get that justice.
Like, I think one thing that still gets me is the jogger who was attacked with the Central Park Five.
Mm-hmm.
She still thinks that the boys were let off and that they should have been kept, like, in jail. Like, and the attorney still thinks that she did nothing wrong. And I don't know if you watched When They See Us. I did. That was one of the most intense things I've watched. And that was after previously watching the Central Park Five documentary. So I knew the story. But just the way that, like, boys, like literally young boys, were just treated. Had they been white, that wouldn't even, their parents would have not let that happen at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I used to watch a lot of movies like that, but I don't, I just can't anymore. It affects me a lot. It affects me to a point where I won't be able to move the next day. I'll be depressed and just want to lay in my bed. But it makes me think about how I kind of progressed, like, throughout childhood to my teenage years to adulthood. And that chip on my shoulder that I mentioned from, like, just being subject to racism and in understanding white supremacy and how it affected me from such a young age, I became sort of militant at a young age, and then, like, progressed to a little bit less militant, and then progressed to what am I trying to say? And then just feeling like I had a good understanding of the world and understanding that I didn't need to be militant, you know, and that happened kind of like in my mid to late 20s. But I'm just glad that I had that experience and that I was really angry and I allowed myself to be angry, and learning that I didn't have to be so angry anymore. That doesn't mean that that rage no longer resides in me. It doesn't mean that at all. But I think I learned that it doesn't really serve me, and that, you know, it could serve me, the anger, but if I don't find a way for it to do so, it's really not that helpful.
All right. Well, on that note, I wanted to move on to just hearing you talk a little bit about what you do and how that has been impacted by your experiences and how you help people.
Yeah. So right now I am a dietitian, a registered dietitian, intuitive eating counselor, nutrition therapist, and I help people break up with diet culture. And I help them do so by recognizing what body oppression is, what the diet mentality is, and what fat phobia is, and understanding where all those thoughts and negative beliefs about their bodies and about themselves, where that comes from or where it came from, and helping them reject that and helping them find food freedom and making peace with their bodies. And I think my experience, my own personal experience, coupled with my training and experience as a social worker, as well as my experience in that traditional weight-centric, weight-normative paradigm, of course, that all informs the work that I do. And I don't think I would be able to really help people get out of that if I didn't have that experience, especially my lived experience, because I helped. I mean, I pulled myself out of that myself. So,
right.
Yeah, so that's what I do. It's really hard for me to separate that work, even though it's nutrition work, from social justice work. And it's hard for me to separate that from, you know, my lived experience as a Black woman and at one point not liking a lot of things about myself. And so when I work with clients, I see so many parts of myself and my own experience in them. You know, and I help them see how the behaviors and the beliefs and that diet mentality, that diet culture mentality doesn't serve them and how it's not helpful. So that's what I do. And yeah, that's how my lived experience.
Awesome. Awesome. So I just wanted to ask you, I ask everyone, just in the last week, this has been a rough week for, I think, both of us. What is like a high moment and a low moment for you?
So I would say the high moment. Yesterday was my 3-year wedding anniversary.
Oh, I saw that.
And yeah.
I loved all the photos.
Thank you. And prior to that, I've just been like really emotionally exhausted. And this has been going on for a couple weeks. And my husband took off work so we could spend the day together. And I felt so energized and it felt really nice. It felt really good. I posted on Instagram for the first time in a really long time. And even that, like posting on Instagram, I look at other people and I feel like, I don't know what's going on with them behind the scenes, but I feel like bitter. Like, how are they, how do they have the energy to post? Like, how are they doing this during this time? You know, and I know comparison doesn't help anybody, but yeah, so that was a really high moment just yesterday, the whole day that I was a little teeny bit productive. It was my 3-year wedding anniversary and we just had a good day. We went for a walk and cooked food and ordered food out. That was a really high moment. And I still feel really good about it.
That's awesome.
I feel like I haven't come down like all the way from it. Yeah. And a low moment, gosh, girl, I've had so many of those. But
we're focusing on just one.
Yeah. Okay. Let's focus on one. Just some mental exhaustion. I'm over it. I'm tired of being tired. And also I think that has to go with, I think it has something to do with Ahmaud Arbery's murder and seeing so many posts about it on social media. It's really having an effect on me, as usual, as all these murders do, that aren't justified. So I would say that is a low moment because sometimes feel like I should be doing more. And I'm not sure what I can do, but I just wish something could be done.
I agree with that. I ended up signing the petition for it to be brought in front of the grand jury, I believe. And I mean, sometimes I really don't think that signing petitions does anything, but I mean, it felt good to do something.
Yeah. The same here. Like I did the petition. And then there was a phone number. I didn't call, but I wrote the phone number down, but yeah.
It's a lot of emotional and honestly, physical labor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot.
So tell our listeners where they can find more information about you or get in touch with you.
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram. I'm probably there the most. My handle is at the Trill RD. That's THETRILLRD. Or you can find me on my website at trulyrealnutrition.com. And if you want to book an appointment or a discovery call to see if we're a good fit to work together, you can do that there.
Definitely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So thank you for speaking with me. I mean, I think we both agree that we could talk about this for forever, but I guess we're going to end it here. But thank you for speaking with me. It's been amazing getting to know you, and I love hearing about how your life story has impacted your work.
Thank you. And thank you for this podcast. And I look forward to hearing more about these conversations on body trauma. I think they're really deep conversations, but I really think we can learn a lot from them. So
I agree.
Thank you, Nia.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you again to Ayanna Habtemarian for telling us her story and for being here today. And thank you to all of you at home for listening to the show. I hope it was a really impactful part of your week. Go ahead and subscribe to our podcast to be notified about our next episodes. If you want to tell us your thoughts about this episode and the podcast in general, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at bodytraumapod@gmail.com. And I would so greatly appreciate it if you would leave a review on iTunes. It really helps us to be seen by more people. Anyways, I'm Nia Patterson, and this is Body Trauma. See you next time.